I would encourage folks to continue eating, make another round of the buffet if you're so inclined, or the desserts in the back. It's my pleasure to introduce our luncheon speaker today. He's well known to probably everyone in this room, so I'm going to be extremely brief with my introduction. Richard Epstein is a good friend of the Federalist Society and a frequent guest and presenter to our group here. He's currently the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institute of Stanford University, and the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor of Law Emeritus and a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago. How we got him here to Washington, I'm not clear, but at those three institutions, he teaches virtually everything, and I'm always impressed when chatting with him to learn that this person and that person and that person, all very accomplished people, are among his former students. I'm certain he's going to teach us something valuable today. So with that, Professor Epstein.
Well, it's very, very nice to be here, and I want to thank Dean for that nice introduction amongst my former students. You're one of mine, right? Well, I know that Adam Massoff is one of my students who the only time I ever taught patent law was when Adam was in the class, and I could assure you he was maybe not the world's greatest student, but he was by definition the most enthusiastic, which is what carries the day in this thing. In fact, he's had an exceptional career, and I've worked with him closely since that time. I was supposed to think of a title for this particular speech, which I don't think that Dean gave, right? But I will give it, because now that I'm in Washington, I will give my political biases and make them clear, and I will talk about patent reform made difficult, what life is like when you come to Washington, D.C. today. And the reason I'm going to do that is because I think the process of reform that one sees in Washington and elsewhere, heavily influenced by what takes place in Washington, has taken a really very different track from what it was a long time ago. If I were asked to sort of describe the most fundamental change that exists in sort of public institutions in the United States since I entered into teaching in 1968, I would say that the following is most true. When I started, I think there was a real sense in Washington and elsewhere that the professionals were dominating the politicians, or to be more accurate about it, they were allowed to proceed with political protection and exercise a certain degree of professional and intellectual independence. I think what has happened with the acceleration of political tensions in the United States, that the political has now overwhelmed the professional, and that it turns out that you cannot count on staffs in various agencies of one kind or another to sort of exercise the independent judgment that is necessary to keep the process in line. And to give you an idea of how this contrast takes place, I'm going to talk about one example that actually occurs inside the patent system. Patent law has always been subject to ups and downs. The level of protection that has been given to patents has increased and decreased in kind of rhythmic cycles. And in the early 1940s and so forth, it became rather clear that there was a fairly strong anti-patent sentiment that was gathering force inside the United States Supreme Court. And it gave rise to a certain degree of anxiety that the balance was going to be tipped a little bit too far in one direction. And so then the question was, how did you organize some sort of a legislative response to this? And the process that followed, that took place, was roughly as follows. President Truman appointed two people. One was Giles Rich, who you clerk for, right, Scott, if I'm not mistaken. And the other was a guy named Federico, if I think I have it right, who was the head of the Patent and Trade Office. They were put together as a committee of two. They found a dining room table somewhere, got a yellow pad, and drafted the 1952 Patent Reform Act. This statute is, in fact, I regard as a rather admirable piece of work when you actually understand it. Rich was probably the foremost practitioner at the time, and Federico was an extremely distinguished judge. They did the whole thing. They then waltzed it up to the Hill, and it passed without modification or change by a voice vote and became the law in 1952. Fast forward about 55, 60 years, and you start to see the American Invents Act. And the first thing that you note about the process is that we have now switched from a patent act to an American Vent Act, kind of a propagandistic title, which has the advantage of being disingenuous, because the single group that was most opposed to the American Vents Act were the American inventors, for the most part, who regarded the statute as a serious compromise with respect to the kinds of rights that were developed under it. There was not a two-man operation that put this thing together. It wasn't short, or as Judge Michael said to me, long enough to cover the subject, but not so long as to be lost in its own details. Instead, what you did is you had a barrage of individuals on all sides lobbying, people in the Hills, committees, industry groups, and so forth. Myself and Scott Keefe actually got involved in this particular thing in connection with various issues associated with kind of business method patents, an issue on which Judge Rich had spoken quite strongly in the State Street case. This thing comes back. It's probably 10 times as long as the original act. It is specialized, it is characterized by highly specialized results in particular areas of one form or another. Nobody quite knows what's going on. If you don't know what to do on substance, well, then you compensate for that ignorance by not knowing what to do on procedure, so that what you do essentially is to get an elongation and prolongation of all kinds of trials in which complexity dominates over clarity. And at the end of the day, you hear the defense of this statute is, well, it did not wreck the system. Which is cannot be, I think, a sufficient defense for the sort of interventions that one starts to see. We are now involved in yet another round, only 3 years later, from the 2011 situation, where we have also mainly procedural kinds of reforms being put forward, which are extraordinary with respect to their detail and complexity. It is ironic, I think, that this particular bill that one sees before the Senate, which I tried to read on the plane, on the train coming down this morning, but didn't have quite enough time to finish, is probably as long as the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure put together, dealing with only one single kind of point. And this, is, I think, shows a very sort of dangerous tendency in which forces of one side or another get together and constantly clash over these things, and it turns out that they're very strong sort of interest group politics that take place. It's not only in government that one starts to see this kind of thing happen. The same thing also happens now in connection with another topic of enormous importance, which has to do with SSOs, standard setting organizations for various kinds of essential patents that are developed one way or another. And the question is, how do you put these things together? It is pretty clear that if you actually look at the process by which these deliberations take place to set standards, there are a variety of RAND obligations that take place, such as reasonable and non-discriminatory treatment with respect to situations. And over the years, there were a very extensive number of safeguards that were put into place to make sure that the kind of balance that you would have between the need to incorporate patents with different technologies from different companies and not to allow exploitation, but to create uniformity, was handled by technical committees of one sort or another, largely outside the scope of judicial review, largely outside the scope of congressional behavior. And what one can do is see a very rapid improvement in the kinds of technical standards that got out there. To somebody who's outside the process, think of me, it often seems quite incomprehensible how the insiders could actually get this thing to work. But to somebody who's on the inside of the situation, they know enough about the convention, there's enough repeat dealing, there are enough people in these various standard setting procedures who act as kind of informal referees between the various sides, that when you start to look at the way in which the product comes, and don't worry so much about the process, what you discover is that there's an enormously rapid rate of advance in all of these kinds of technological industries. So now, in effect, what we have to do against this background is to figure out where the case for reform comes, given what I think was a huge American technical success, A, on the public side with the 1952 Patent Act, and B, on the private side with the standard-setting organizations. And here is what I think generally happens. As you start to look at these kinds of cases, you can ask yourself, well, what are the kinds of reasons that you want to have a reform, and what are the sorts of response that you want to have once that particular reason is identified? And generally speaking, what you want to do in order to inspire a reform is to show that there's some kind of genuine breakdown in a system, incrustation, confusion, and so forth, that requires some response. And generally, the response that you want to have once you've identified the particular problem is one that works towards a simplification of the basic rules under which these various operations start to take place. And if you use this particular standard, in many cases what you see in Washington is exactly the opposite. What happens is you find an industry that really thrives, is doing extremely well by itself, and then some political entrepreneur comes along and says, you know, what we really need to do now is to regulate it, because even though they've had 80% growth on an annualized basis, it's not large enough. If we had my reforms, it would have even been harder. So one of the legislation pieces that I worked on some years ago was the Durbin Amendment, this misguided piece of legislation by Dick Durbin on credit cards, in which he decided to cap interchange fees for debit cards, largely at the request of Walgreens and other companies inside the great state of Illinois, which said that we're paying too much for these kinds of services. And he managed to do a huge amount of damage to this particular industry. And the question you start asking yourself is, why do you want to have a system of price caps imposed upon an industry which, from a dead still start in 1995, had by both volume of transactions on the one hand and by total dollar amount on the other, passed the credit card? You would have said, hey, this is absolutely terrific. Why do you want to change this? And if you get a little bit closer and you start thinking about the telecommunications industries and you worry about the recent reforms for net neutrality and so forth, what you really have to do is to ask yourself, do you really think that you're going to do a lot better in the telecommunications industry when, in fact, the year-over-year progress on this industry has probably been measured by 10, 20, 30% growth of one kind or another, so that the cost of information now is but a tiny fraction of what it was in 1995. And yet what you do is you see people coming forward and saying, these are the kinds of crises that try men's souls, that this is the particular situation in which we must move furiously forward in order to make sure that things will happen. When it comes to the kinds of questions that we're worried about in the patent space, the central question that you have to ask is, what are the kinds of rules that, generally speaking, are going to do well? Where do they occasionally break down, and what ought we to do about them? So I'm going to give a little primer on what I think to be the appropriate way of thinking about intellectual property law, against which you could then test some of the various kinds of reforms. And basically what happens is, I think people who think about intellectual property law as a discrete area, completely uninformed by general principles of property law that develop with respect to land and chattels and waters and the spectrum and everything else that I've taught over the years along with property, are making a very serious intellectual mistake. What happens is, if you look at these various areas, they're extremely sophisticated and they develop all sorts of compromises and rules to figure out how it is that they work. If you treat intellectual property in general, or patents in particular, as though it's a field unto itself, what you're doing is you're cutting yourself off from all this accumulated wisdom on the structure of basic rights on the one hand and on the choice of remedies on the other. And you're now going to essentially fly blind into an area which you do not fully understand. So the question you have to do is to ask, how much of this basic material can you carry over? How much of it do you have to start from scratch? And the principle that I like to call the carryover principle has the basic following first premise. If you look at standard property rights and land forever, what you do is you see that exclusivity turns out to be the dominant characteristic, so that one person or a group of individuals can take a particular piece of property and develop it as they see fit. And then, having given them exclusivity, what happens is their rights to dispose of that property means that they can now enter into transactions, either simple or complex, which allow for gains in trade. And that the only way in which you could start to keep this system efficient is to make sure that there's strong remedies if people want to short circuit the system and basically disrupt exclusivity, which means that you give injunctions. And the only reason that you temper injunctions is, in certain kinds of cases, funny sorts of necessities and non-competitive situations mean that the right to exclude turns out to be too serious. So you have rules that deal with RAND obligations, fair and reasonable obligations, precisely because of monopoly positions associated with common carriers, which is a direct analog to the problem that you have to face with respect to standard-setting organization. You then understand that with respect to land, generally these rights happily go on forever, because there's no particular reason to truncate them, because there's no social benefit that comes from a division of the property rights that I have today and putting something in the public domain tomorrow. When you get to intellectual property, the following propositions hold. Two of these things are true, and the third one now turns out to be false. The ones that are true are that the notion of exclusivity becomes absolutely critical in order to get incentives. When you're talking about the labor theory of value in some sense or another, you don't mean what Marx meant by it. The more you spend on something, the more it's worth. What you mean by it is, in effect, is that those people who engage in labor should be able to get a return from that labor, and exclusivity is the only way in which they can do that. And the only way in which you can enforce exclusivity is through injunctive relief as the basic kind of protection. Then, of course, gains from trade are every bit as important for intellectual property as elsewhere. Sometimes it turns out that these trades take place through sale. More often in the intellectual property space, they tend to take place through licensing kinds of arrangements of amazing complexity. None of these are directed by the state. You figure out whether it's exclusive or non-exclusive. You figure out whether it's reciprocal or non-reciprocal. You figure out whether or not they're pooled or not pooled. And the appropriate role of the state in this circumstance is to make sure that you don't have licensing arrangements in restraint of trade, just as when you're dealing with various kinds of physical properties, you don't want to allow the people who make machine tools on the one hand or mine phosphorus on the other hand the ability to form cartels that sell to the rest of the world. So the stuff with respect to exclusion and cooperation are the same. The stuff with respect to the durability of the interests are not. And what happens quite simply is this. In intellectual property, if the information is available, anybody could use it without diminishing the ability of somebody else to use it. So it's not like a farm where if I happen to be going up and down that furrow, nobody else could enter it. Once this idea, in fact, is known, the marginal cost of its adoption by somebody else is zero. So what we do is we form a very nice compromise. We give a period of time longer for copyrights than for patents, which says, in this first period, there's exclusivity, and that's what gets you the invention. And then after that time, it goes into the common domain. That gets you the wide circulation. This, again, is not unique unto intellectual property. If you go back to the 19th century and figure out how it was that people financed the construction of new bridges out of public funds, what they did is they gave a company an exclusive for 20 years, after which they had to open up the rolls, covering only their incremental costs thereafter. Exactly the same kind of problem with a different kind of public good. So that's the model that you want to have with respect to this area. And I'm afraid that when you start to listen to the way things go today, what you do is you see the same kinds of attacks on intellectual property structures that I've talked about as you see with respect to general property structures. To give you but one example, the first argument article of a very famous man, Mark Lemwin, tried to explain why it is that when you start looking at the various kinds of licenses that take place, what you really have to be worried about is contracts of adhesion of one kind or another so that you could not allow certain kinds of practices to take place. Well, this is identical to the argument that Fritz Kessler made in 1943 about exactly the same subject, talking about contracts of adhesion as though they were a form of domination. But of course, it was wrong in the general case, and it's wrong in the intellectual property case. There are many reasons why you have standardization. One of them is it ensures customers that they're going to be parity. If you know as an unsophisticated customer you're going to get the same deal as a sophisticated customer, it reduces the search costs that you have to face, and so you could expand the scope of the market. It allows you, in effect, to constrain your personnel in a fashion that they can now work together because they don't have to figure out why each particular deal is different one from another. And if you're in a competitive market, the terms that are going to come out of a standardized agreement are likely to be efficient, not to be inefficient. So what's not to like? And all of the work that's been done with shrink wrap licenses and click wrap licenses have generally established that they do not create any form of illicit market power, and these huge efforts to figure out how these things ought to be regulated only slow up the wheels of commerce. They don't give you any valuable and new information. This is a classic illustration of what happens when you start with the general theory and get that right, carry it over to the intellectual property theory, and you don't miss a beat. If you start to assume that intellectual property is somehow or other distinct and beyond all compare, you're only showing the fact that you've never experienced not only property with respect to ordinary chattels, but, for example, how complex networks were put together in things like the railroad and telecommunications industry long before intellectual property was developed. Same thing also takes place when you start to look at this thing from the procedural side. And although Mr. Phillips is not here today, this was my reaction when I listened to his speech and when I looked at this incredibly complicated bill, which occupied so much of my time on the train coming down. We passed in 1938 the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And this was the last stage in what was generally a relatively benevolent set of reforms that started with the simplification of the common law rules of action in the field codes in the United States and the Common Law Procedure Acts in England in the 1850s. It got simplified a little bit further by code pleading. We decided to have one form of action rather than to have the old forms of action that were explained so wonderfully by Maitland writing about this issue in the last part of the 19th century. And what you did is you essentially started with the following proposition. We want people to file simple complaints in clear and concise languages. Then we're going to use the discovery process to figure out the extent to which these things are true and false. What was clearly wrong about the federal rules is they thought that everything was a collision on Boylston Street or a simple action for had and received. They did not quite figure out what was going on when you had really complicated litigation like antitrust disputes of one sort or another. And I think it could be said about the federal rules of civil procedure that they did make one fundamental structural mistake, which is they put a little bit too much weight on the open-ended nature of the discovery proceedings and would have been better off on average following something like the English rule, which meant that in complex litigation there would be a special master who would limit and structure the way in which discovery would start to take place. But if you note, when I'm talking about this as a mistake, I'm not talking about it as a mistake for the patent law in particular. I'm talking about it as a mistake for all forms of complex litigation. And so what happens is when you start to deal with the reform on discovery, and on reform on pleading, you don't want, I think, as the Corn Bill does, to sort of single out patent litigation for some kind of special treatment, where in fact you may have rules that are rather artificial and mistaken. Rather, what you want to do is to figure out how it is that you reform the entire process of litigation more generally, and if you get complex litigation correct in the larger set of cases, you're going to get it correct in this particular case as well. Because here, as in the other areas, there is less distinctive in patent litigation than often meets the eye. The essential point turns out to be that if you have a complaint, you'd like to be able to resolve the issues of law and demur very quickly. But if you have factual questions, either you structure the discovery in some kind of coherent fashion, or everything will run out of control. And we can make those kinds of reforms, but I think what happens is you're not going to make those kinds of reforms if what you do is respond to the sort of special pleadings of this, that, or the other goods, groups in particular, worrying about retail guys who think that they've been sued, sometimes I believe quite correctly, by patent trolls or by people engaged in frivolous litigation, but treat this as a frivolous litigation problem that goes across the board. Don't treat this as a problem which applies uniquely to this particular area. There is some question as to who or what is a troll. Nobody quite can give you a definition about this, because again, if you start to talk about the specialization of firms into litigation, or the specialization of firms into invention, or the specialization of firms in production, there is nothing about that division which is inherently problematic. It turns out that specialization and expertise matters in every industry, and just as ordinary people, when they have bills to collect, send them over to bill collectors if they can't collect them evenly, so it is that patent enforcement entities may do, in fact, exactly the same thing. If you've got the right set of general rules and these guys have to labor under them, the problem will take care of itself. If you have the wrong set of rules, all forms of litigation are going to be in trouble. Now, how do you get the right set of rules? And this raises something which I think we tend not to worry enough about when we're dealing with the balancing situation. When I listened to Mr. Phillips this morning, I waited with bated breath to hear the word two kinds of error come forth from his lips. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean, when you engage in litigation, it's a struggle. It's a bilateral monopoly. The only guy I can sue is the infringer, and he can't decide, gee, I don't like this particular plaintiff. I'm going to go to the supermarket and find myself somebody else who can sue me instead. So once you have this sort of bilateral monopoly, you have to have it as a form of regulated combat, and you never quite know who's the bull and who's the toreador in all of these cases. You never quite know who's wearing the good hat and who's wearing the bad hat, and you never know whether or not the errors that you're going to make are going to be weighed too much in favor of the plaintiff or too much in favor of the defendant. What happens in the modern discourse is that we get too much of the, my side is in a terrible situation, therefore you have to do something to ease our errors. And so the question you always have to ask in all of these cases, if you slow down the process by which you can start to file a complaint, you're not only doing it for bad actors, you're also doing it for good actors. So to take one of the things that came up in the discussion earlier today, there is the question of just how much pre-trial investigation you want to do before you decide to initiate litigation. And generally speaking, any firm which has the slightest bit of brains in its head will decide that it has to do some. The only question is, what's the quantum? And from its private point of view, the basic choice is one of diminishing marginal utility. First, I do as much on the outside. If I think, in fact, I can't get any other information except at great cost, it's now cheaper for me to sue than not. The difficulty with this argument is when you sue, the social costs to the other side necessarily come into account. But in these cases, remember, there are two things that can happen. You can have a plaintiff who essentially is a troll, or you can have a defendant who essentially is a bulldog and tries to ice a case by refusing to cooperate with respect to the discovery. So that you have both kinds of error. And it may well be in some cases that you have to sue in order to get those key documents and those key diagrams which will allow you to understand that some degree of infringement has taken place or give you evidence as to whether or not willfulness has taken place as well. And so to make a categorical rule that we think it's always more efficient from a social point of view to organize the world that most of the investigation is done prior to the time of suit may in fact misunderstand the way in which the overall system is working. So what do we then do when we think about litigation? And this has generally been my view, and I'm going to state it here, which is the first thing you want to do is to have very clear rules of the road. That's why I like strong injunctions, for example, with respect to patents. Because the point of clear rules of the road is it reduces the probability that there's going to be a collision or a threat of collision. But once it turns out that the rules of the road have not stopped the particular abuse and a collision draws unnigh, I am unaware of any fixed set of rules which will tell you what it is that you can do. So to give you a tort parallel to what I'm talking about here, assume that we want to get a system of traffic rules. How does it go? Well, the first thing you do is you actually devise the rules of the road, and these have to be internally consistent, which mean, roughly speaking, that no two people can be at the same place at the same time, because if they are, they're going to crash. And then what you do is you try to figure out how these rules of the road are going to maximize the level of traffic flow across the lanes, through the intersections, and all the rest of it. And generally speaking, you will invest in infrastructure called red lights and line dividers and all the rest of those things to keep these cars apart and to increase the speed and reliability if they can move. And if you do this right, then 99.9% of your journeys will take place utterly without adventure because people will always remain within the rules. But suppose somebody now goes off the tracks and he evades into the wrong lane or runs a red light. What's the other fellow supposed to do? Well, you can try and figure out a rule that responds to it, and you will fail, because you don't know whether you should turn to the left, turn to the right, speed up, slow down. You don't know. So what do we say? We say, in the event of various kinds of confusions like that, you have to take reasonable steps in good faith to minimize the likelihood of harm. Now, there's nothing that I've been able to think of in 40-odd years of teaching law which allows me to eliminate those ugly words, reasonable and good faith. They are essentially part of the system, and it requires a certain degree of good judgment on people as to how they respond. That's why you like experienced drivers. And if there's a jury trial, it requires somebody to figure out what's going on. The same thing is true with patent infringement. What basically happens is if you have clear rules, you reduce the frequency of bad interactions. But once they start to occur, the thought that you can somehow or other pre-program the way in which you're going to issue an injunction or a stay and do this by way of general legislation will always fail. What you have to understand at this point, going that down to this tiny fraction of cases that have failed, something's going to defend, unfortunately, on the good judgments of judges, Judge Michel. There's just no way that you can get out of that particular problem. We have all these rules about sound discretion for a reason, because you have to exercise discretion. Presumptively it's sound, but in the rare case, on top it doesn't. If there's too much discovery, you order left and so forth. So the first line of defense in all of these cases is an able set of professionals who are running these kinds of systems, who are fully aware of the two kinds of errors associated with its operation, and then try and figure out how it makes incremental adjustments, in this case this way, and in that case the other. So when you have things like the Corin Bill, which are much more efforts to sort of pre-program everything into the system, what's going to happen is it will fail. They will not get the balances right. They themselves will use terms that they don't quite understand. The whole question about fee shifting on an ad hoc basis, clear losers, yes, not so clear losers, no. Well, 95% of the cases are going to be clear and 5% of the cases are not going to be clear. And there's a real question as to whether or not you've put in the sort of institutional arrangements that will allow you how to figure out how you decide all of these marginal cases. So what is it, I think, that you start to learn from all of this stuff is as follows. You got to be very careful when you start to tamper with these institutions. You also have to worry very seriously about whether or not you're going to introduce the very peril that you're trying to avoid. So to close, let me go back again to the standard setting operations. And as I indicated to you, the question of reasonable and non-discriminatory terms is not one that was invented in the patent space. It's one that was invented the moment you had your first common carrier. And what you're clearly trying to do in these cases is to make somebody who's got a pivot position not exert monopoly powers. But one of the things that you must always remember is sometimes the effort to control ostensible monopolies creates monopolies instead. So if you start looking at the various rules associated with predatory pricing in the United States, you start allowing antitrust actions against predation, what happens is you strengthen incumbents against competition, and what you do is you retard rather than advance social welfare. And generally speaking, the antitrust laws, I think, have come up with a fairly serious awareness that you divide the world into two stages. One is you've got these horizontal conspiracies, and these are the things you have to stop. And then you have these very complicated kinds of vertical arrangements of which standard-setting organizations are part of it, where regulation is very difficult to achieve, and the antitrust law has generally relatively limited scope. If you look at the standard-setting rules that are now before the IEEE, it turns out there's a serious question of whether or not when they introduce these rather artificial pricing devices, which say ignore the rights that somebody has to enforce a particular patent through an injunction, which of course is what you ought never to enjoin, whether or not what you're doing is creating a buyer-side cartel, which is a per se violation under the antitrust laws. So the thing to remember about all of these reforms is that it's not as though too much of a good thing is a great thing. This is not Mae West speaking about her favorite occupation. It turns out in some of these cases, too much of a good thing is a bad thing. And in all of these situations, you must not only look at the abuse that you're curing, but you also have to keep a weather eye out for the abuse that you might be creating. So what this does, I think, is create a weak and responsible bias in favor of the status quo. It's never going to be absolute, but it says that in the world of reform, you want to pinpoint what the defects are and try to get a remedy that simplifies the way in which the legal system works rather than complexifies it further. And one of the problems about doing reform in Washington, D.C. this day is that we've become so complicated that we manage to do it very badly most of the time. The technique questions are, in fact, very, very important in this business. And, you know, Carl Llewellyn said it, I can never quite get it right. He said, you know, principles, if you have technique without principles, you're a menace, right? And if you have, If you have principles without technique, you're a menace. If you have technique without principles, you're a mess. And you have to be able to get this whole thing done. It's a real question of adjusting the means to the ends and the ends to the means. And one of the things that's hardest to legislate and hardest to understand is a sense of proportion. And that, I fear, is what is missing much too often in this fair town of Washington, D.C. Thank you. I'll take a question. If not, I'll have to run down there and ask my own question. Oh, man, this can't be such a reticent crowd. This is being taped. Oh, I see a man. All right.
Professor Epstein, you mentioned standard setting, and it seems that the IEEE proposal IEEE may have asked for Justice Department input and review. There's a tradition in Europe of governmental European Commission involvement in guidance and standard setting. Up to now, or at least very recently, there has been no such tradition in the United States. Indeed, U.S. government documents traditionally have said this is sort of private sector driven, market driven. Do you perceive any drift towards government involvement, greater government involvement by the U.S. government in standard setting, and what are the implications?
Well, the answer is, it seems to me, there's been a recent uptick in the amount of litigation when there's been mistakes or disagreements with respect to standards. To some extent, that's actually built into the standard rules because, generally speaking, these things are not completely done without the possibility of litigation, either to implement the standard on the one hand or to resist it on the other. So what you have to ask yourself is whether or not the change in the frequency and the type of these particular interventions has moved markedly. One of the things that's most conspicuous about the few cases that I've read on this subject is when they're trying to set the permissible range as to where the applicable standard could be, the range is sufficiently broad that even after you get that information, you still have a terrible tussle as figuring where within this particular range that you go. I think what's really happened in the United States in general is that we've now developed basically a mindset which says that whenever we look at various kinds of institutions that are engaged in complicated coordination deals, we stress the imperfections rather than the gains. So what you do is you look at these things, you figure out all the things that can possibly go wrong, you assume that they're all going to go wrong sort of simultaneously. At that particular point, government comes in because they could cure the difficulty. What happens is you don't take a baseline which includes all the standards that have been set more or less without incident and treat them as the guide. So the worry that I always have when you start going to the Department of Justice and the Antitrust Division or anything else is that in an effort to judicialize the way in which the process will work, a lot of the benefits from informality associated with their operations will start to be lost. And it's an extremely difficult trade-off to figure out what's going on. One reason why I think the problem is more intense today is you take something, for example, like the standards that are used for setting your fourth generation system with respect to Wi-Fi and so forth. The dollar amounts that are involved in these standards are so spectacularly enormous that all of a sudden it pays to fight. And one of the basic rules that you know about any kind of informal negotiation is that if the stakes are relatively low, generally speaking, it's a little bit easier to reach some kind of an agreement. If the stakes turn out to be enormous, the earlier set of institutional arrangements may not be strong enough to withstand the battering. So it's very difficult to figure out how this thing is going to work, meaning you don't know whether or not it shifts in technology and shifts in the amount in controversy, shifts in the number of parties that are driving the frequency of litigation, or whether it turns out it's this fly-specking which takes place. But I am always impressed by the following general observation, which is when people start to talk to me, they say, you know, we don't have a purely competitive market because goods are not infinitely indivisible in the world. We therefore have an imperfect market. But that tells you nothing. An imperfect market, which is 98% fine, is a perfect market. An imperfect market, which has got 10% fine and 90% wrong, is a bad market. So it's the amount of imperfection and the cost of cure which really matters. And the simple fact that you can show that everything deviates from the pure competitive model tells you nothing about the institutional question of whether or not you want to intervene. My own view, when you start seeing the factional struggles over something like the IEEE standards and so forth, and you see the real monopoly dangers here, you now know why people are trying to go to the antitrust division, because they're trying to get immunity from potential suit. This has happened in many cases, the worst of which is the stuff associated with the Wright Amendments or the Wright Amendment and so forth, having to do with the way in which you organize travel going out of the Dallas-Fort Worth airport region. Straight cartel of the worst sort, put together for the worst reason by people who should have known better, and they go to Congress because they have to get its approval because they know otherwise they're going to be sued under the antitrust law. And generally speaking, I am deeply suspicious of anybody who wants to go to Washington to get an antitrust immunity or exemption. That's sort of a basic working proposition, and I think it applies in this area as much as any other. Yes, Randy.
Okay, so this is not a patent question, but a political science question, so we'll go in this direction. You contrasted the way Washington used to work back in 1952, or even more recently, and the way it's broken now or doesn't work, and you've decried that. So since you've taught most of the courses that any law school can teach or university, what do you think, what would you like to see change in your view that would make Washington, quote, work more like it used to? You know, some people mention redistricting, some people campaign finance. I don't happen to agree with those things necessarily, but what would you think should change to make Washington work better?
Well, let me start and treat this as a straight public choice political economy question, because I think that's the spirit in which you've addressed it. I think the basic problem that we have in Washington is property rights have become indefinite so that political activities become necessary. The more uncertainty there is over the structure of rights, the less political consensus there is as to what these things should be, the more resources now become contestable. So, for example, when I talked about the IEEE standards, one of the real questions is there's always going to be a surplus from invention, and ought that surplus to be allocated to the innovators through these processes, or should it be allocated to the other side? If you run them through voluntary negotiations, the innovators will tend to hold the high cards because they have the distinctive resource, and if they have the distinctive resource, that's the thing that, generally speaking, should get the super competitive return, because that's the thing that's going to drive innovation. But if you then look at the way in which these things are structured in terms of the pricing mechanism, it's a quite conscious effort to essentially transfer all the surplus from these particular observations from the producers to the consumers by the way in which you deny injunctions until there's an appellate court relief on the one hand, or by trying to define the base over which you give the royalty so narrowly that you ignore all the synergistic elements that are gotten by putting the standard together and take all of those synergistic gains and allocate them to the other side. And sure enough, you have this huge political fight that's taking place over that issue. Now, it happens in lots of other industries. Look, you do telecommunications, and here, you know, we've had some good news and some bad news. If you go back to the old comparative hearings that were loved by Felix Frankfurter back in the 1930s, he says, I've got this valuable asset, and what I'm going to do is make sure that it goes to the party who best serves the public interest. Here are 19 criteria that you can put into place. And then it turns out to be an absolute mess trying to figure out what happens. So what takes place is you spend fortunes bidding for this thing, and then the guy who gets the license is entitled to assign it, take all the remedies to himself after he's operated or not for a single year. So it became quite clear that the system kind of worked. What you did is you had a corrupt system of initial allocation, and then you had a system of market correction. The problem was the government didn't get a dime out of this particular system. It was the lucky applicant who got the dime. So you had a corrupt process at the front end, after which there was an imperfect correction. If you just figured out what the property rights that you want to create in spectrum are and how those things ought to be put together, then the only question you have is the technical one of how it is that you manage to run a bid over space, knowing in effect that you can't sell it off in one block, and knowing further that adjacent blocks combined together have a value greater than each of these two blocks considered separately. And you get the pros to figure out how they bid, how they trade afterwards. That's just a massive improvement of what's going on. But in the patent space, the moment you announce, for example, that injunctions are really up for grabs, now it means that the ability of people to circumvent the system and say, sue me, becomes a viable option. Property rights are going to be weaker. Once they're weaker, then you're going to go into the political spectrum. One side's going to try to shore them up, and other side is going to try to make sure that they go weaker still. So you see the degeneration start to take place. Take something like healthcare, and you're not quite sure what you should buy and what you should sell. You're going to go to the administration and say, you know what? Tax the medical device guys, because they won't join up with your party quickly enough. And then subsidize all the people like pharmaceuticals and so forth who are willing to pay ball by giving them a guaranteed market. So what you do is you create another set of monopolies and another set of taxes in order to reward your friends. Now, where do I think the problem starts? Well, I would say it starts at the Supreme Court. And the reason I say that is one of the sad features about our modern jurisprudence is they regard property rights as essentially an archaic notion devised by a bunch of people who wore funny kinds of togas on the one hand or wigs on the other hand, rather than being an essential constituent of modern organization. So they give only a rational basis test by which you're going to start to protect these things, which means that they're opening up the field to all of these kinds of political situations. And unless they start to realize that they have created created an enormous amount of social losses and are prepared to tighten up on these things, it's not going to happen. So what's the great achievement of the 1930s from the point of view of a property rights guy like myself? Is what the Supreme Court managed to sanction were consistent legislative efforts at the state and the federal level in which you taught well-operating competitive markets and turned them into various kinds of cartels. This takes a lot of genius, right? What you do is you spend money at the public trough in order to reduce output. That's what happened in agriculture, that's what happened in labor, that's what happened for a large part in zoning, that's what happened with respect to motor vehicles. You find a progressive reform, you will find a state monopoly at the back end of that one way or another. And that mentality is what drives it. You get a president like Obama, and you get a rather liberal Congress, and tendencies that might have been held somewhat in check by the professional nature of staffs, all of a sudden, they now become the wondrous things that we're trying to do, because you now have an administration that thinks that 1935 was sort of the gold age in the political economy. They call themselves progressives again, and they're out there trying to create these state monopolies that they could then tax on the one hand and run on the other. If that's going to be your mental situation, what will happen is technology will keep you afloat. You're not going to have a Great Depression of one sort or another. But what you can predict is what has happened, and what I predicted many years ago, there will be a slow erosion in the overall standard of living because the economy will be more or less stagnant. There will now be greater divisions between rich and poor because virtually every piece of protective legislation hurts the people whom it's supposed to protect. So that getting a 40-hour-a-week job if you're somebody who's unskilled is a virtual impossibility today because we tax those jobs to death. And unless you go through all of that, you're not going to solve it. And to my view, at least some fraction of the modern concern with patent reform is simply an outgrowth of this kind of progressive tradition. And for these purposes, I don't care whether it's Democrats or Republicans. In fact, one of the really appalling situations is that so many of these things are bipartisan. I have worked on behalf of many institutional investors dealing with Fannie and Freddie, and this was a situation where the government simply declared itself a dividend of all the profits of these companies, and it's the Republicans who are defending this particular kind of theft by legislation with equal ferocity as the Democrats, and it's a Republican judge, Royce Lamberth, who sees no evil, hears no evil, and essentially approves of the kind of transaction that takes place. Unfortunately, we do have bipartisanship today in exactly the wrong places. Question?
Professor, thanks very much for your excellent speech. Just a little constructive criticism for your next speech, because I know you speak a lot. Next time, a little more substance and a little faster would be better.
I'm sorry. Damn. I'm losing my touch.
You actually just, I think now, after I got up, you were kind of addressing the question I have, but just maybe say a little bit more about it. Why now? Because assuming as Professor Mossoff and others, USPTO has rightly pointed out, there's not an increase in the patent litigation rate, contrary to what the other side says. What is it now that's precipitating this bipartisan rush? Why wasn't this happening 30 years ago?
Well, first of all, I think there's a genuine change in the political culture. Think of who you have as president. And then understand, I think, that on both the Republican and the Democratic side, the populist impulse is much stronger now than it's ever been before. Because a populist impulse is something that doesn't play to markets, which don't vote. Populist impulses change to basically voters who do vote. And to the extent that you can promise them benefits through the political process that they can't get through market processes, they're going to sort of line up more or less behind you. So what you always have to do in these debates is to say, what you must understand is every direct benefit that you get by way of legislation in your favor, say a higher minimum wage law, now called a living wage law, something of the sort, carries with it a hidden cost. And that hidden cost is going to come back on you as much as everybody else. And so the way in which I give the speech is I said, look, I am not going to engage in a battle of anecdotes. I'm not going to write my New York story about the person who was laid off from a job and found it impossible to pay for his or her medical bills and so forth. What I'm going to do is talk about naked, boring statistics. And what those show is a consistent decline in the median income in the United States of about 1% a year for about the last 7 or 8 years. And this has happened at exactly the same time that these protections started to be put into place. Well, you would say, you know, correlation is not causation. And I say, that's absolutely right. But correlation with a theory does in fact amount to causation, and I've given you what that theory is. Every time you deviate from a competitive equilibrium, you shrink the pie, and then the only question is who's going to bear the losses. It turns out that the nimble individuals are those with high levels of education and great political access, so they'll turn out to be just fine. It's the folks who have neither of those two things who will take it in the chops. So I always send a thank you note to the president. Dear Mr. President, thank you for introducing all of these ridiculous pieces of legislation because it allows me to secure gainful employment with a clear conscience in trying to fight you with only middling success. Yours truly, Richard Epstein. But I think, I mean, this is basically, I think, what has happened. And I mean, you speak to anybody who disagrees, starting from the president on down, and what you typically discover is that general equilibrium theory is of no interest to them. What they're only interested in is figuring out a target population which will allow them to put together a winning coalition. And you do this often enough and you succeed, and my nightmare turns out to come true. Now, how you get this across to a popular audience, to some extent it's a genuine problem. Since I speak so slowly and I speak so concretely, I may not be the perfect person to sort of do this thing, but this is the only message I think that you can have, which is that the traditional theory of strong property rights, injunctive relief, voluntary contracts, antitrust controls, right, which is what I was pushing for, is the greatest message for human prosperity that you can come up with. If you don't believe that, you better tell me what you're going to put into place, and I will tell you it will be case after case and industry after industry where these are all failed experiments from which we do not work. Socialism does not work in the round where you have a centralized government trying to set goods and prices. If it doesn't work in the concrete cases, you have to be very careful as to where you put it into practice. The old English common law accommodation done before the benefit of modern theory said you'll look at somebody who has a natural monopoly, and that's where you start thinking about rate regulation, which is low enough to excise the monopoly rent and large enough to allow the firm to remain in business. That became the hallmark as early as 1810. It turns out it's real difficult to do, but it's impossible to do if you don't understand that that's the particular social objective that you're trying to achieve. Okay? Any other question, or should I go home? Thank you.
Well, thank you all. Thank you, Richard Epstein. We certainly appreciate you being here, making the trip down here for that speech and the Q&A. I want to thank the audience, especially for your patience enduring this morning as we experienced an unexpected delay, but I think we got a lot of substance in, as has been suggested. And I want to thank all our previous panelists for participating today, but I especially want to thank the audience for being here and for your participation. Thank you very much, everyone.